Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Okay, we move now into our panel session. We have time for questions from the floor. We have a roving microphone, so if you just indicate in the traditional manner by waving in a friendly way towards me, I'll direct the microphone towards you. If you don't mind giving us your name and where you're from, that's helpful to those others here. But if you want to make up a name and organisation, that's fine as well. I think there's lots of things we could pick up on there. Just to make clear to you, though, of course, all the presentations, I saw a lot of you trying to scribble some of those last slides, which had a lot on. The presentations will be available on the website tomorrow. So welcome questions, but also any short comments or clarifications. Really, it's your conference. It's what you want to get out of it. So who would like to start us off with the first question or comment? I know nobody ever wants to go first. I've always got plenty of my own ready, and I'm happy to use them, but don't want to jump in before anyone else has a chance. Okay, yes, on the corner and then in there. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. I'm blessed with a cough as well. It's Chris Hall, Bournemouth University. The question is for Vincenzo. I particularly like your risk, quality risk versus financial risk. It's obvious that Nottingham has, in terms of establishing branch campuses overseas, is probably the UK leader. Without giving away commercially sensitive information, how have you compromised quality with financial risk?
Well, the emphasis has been on trying to maintain quality, because ultimately if you damage... In both of the markets that we've opened up, starting off with Malaysia, we had a long-established activity in Malaysia, large numbers of students coming from Malaysia to the UK. So we had to be careful not to damage our existing activity through the development of the campus in Malaysia. And we've spent quite large sums of money. So, you know, if you're thinking of doing TNE for the money, there are easier ways of making money than opening branch campuses. We've spent significant sums of money in getting staff out to Malaysia and to China who already have had a Nottingham experience. So they're taking Nottingham with them. What's interesting is that after, you know, nearly 13, 14 years now of this kind of activity, we're now seeing traffic in the other direction. So, you know, we have a colleague in the UK who started life in China, went to Malaysia, and now is based in the UK. So it's not just one-way traffic.
Yes, do you want to come back on that?
It's just that I think that there are so many universities considering establishing branch campuses overseas. I mean, if you were to give us a timeline before you'd even think about breaking even on these, are we talking 10 years, 15
and
years?
And it's how you define breaking even, because I think one of the interesting things that we haven't done at Nottingham that I've been trying to do is draw up a non-financial balance sheet. So, you know, the non-financial costs and benefits to these activities. And it's quite clear that there are large benefits from the activities that we're doing in China. But there's a whole series of hidden costs as well in all of these activities. And I talked about, you know, making sure your underpinning systems are in place, your student record systems, your finance systems. You have staff trained in these professional areas who can cope internationally. It's taken us, you know, 10 years to almost be there. So, it's a long road.
Okay. Thank you very much.
But Vincenzo, if there'd been no prospect of financial gain from it, presumably Nottingham University wouldn't have gone ahead with getting overseas branch campuses.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the key is that, you know, the Vice Chancellor who led these initiatives, Colin Campbell, kept on saying, you know, the university doesn't have shareholders; it's a not-for-profit organisation. We need to make money, but the money that we make is reinvested into the services and facilities that we have, both in the UK and overseas. And if you look at some of the interesting developments that are taking place now at our China and Malaysia campuses, you know, activities like Crops for the Future. We have very strong activity in tropical agriculture. It's based in Loughborough, or was until recently, not a very tropical climate. We've launched Crops for the Futures now in Malaysia. It's giving opportunities to staff that we didn't have 10 years ago.
Okay, and I think there was a question just down here. We could get the mic down to the front here, second row back. Okay. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Kate Clark. I'm from the Open University, but I'm also here waving the flag for the Council of Validating Universities today. And I'd like to do two for one, if you
yes,
allow me. The first is a question for Joe. a quick one, I think, which is how is HE Global funded? And the second was a comment, really, for Kevin. And some of the very interesting new markets that you were identifying, Kevin, and it's just an observation, really, which is around sustainability of starting partnerships in some of those places where you haven't... unless you take the Nottingham model and you are able to take Nottingham there and take your university there, if you're looking at recruiting local staff, it's really difficult in some of those places because you just haven't got the capacity in those countries to start up your partnership.
So okay. Joe, do you want to start off? How is HE Global funded?
Yep. HE Global is funded at the moment partly through existing resources within the international unit and Universities UK, but also we have had a grant of money, government money, for HE Global, which has come from, I think, UK Trade and Investment. And certainly one of the things that we're exploring at the moment is the opportunity for further secondments of actual staff from within partner organisations coming to work within the international unit to take forward strands of HE Global. So it's kind of funded by various individuals at the minute.
Will there be any charges to any universities, institutions wanting to use your services?
There's no charges at the moment, but I think clearly that's a potential option depending on how things develop. There might be elements of it that become sort of paid for services, but clearly that's that's certainly one for the future, and nothing's been decided on that as yet.
Okay, and Kevin, the sustainability of new markets.
Yeah, I mean, I think the analysis I gave was really a sort of a macro overview. These are the countries where we see potential in terms of the openness of the foreign government, in terms of the student demand. It didn't really take into account those issues, which obviously are very true. And I think, British Council can say, these are the potential markets. It's obviously up to universities, individual universities, to decide if they can operate in those environments. And some of the ones I mentioned are not really viable in the next few years, but potentially if things stabilise or think that there may be those opportunities. So I think you're right, Kate, but it wasn't really taken into account when I did the analysis.
Okay, thank you. Just there, and then we'll come behind.
Sean Mackin from the Higher Education Academy. My question is about markets, partners, and ethics. In the light of the LSE's experience and then the Wolf report on that, I wonder what advice the panel might give in relation to the sort of ethical frameworks and set of ethical principles that they use when assessing which markets and which partners they wish to work with.
Okay. Robin, do you want to start us off on that, on the whole ethics?
Yes. I'll start off, but from a Leadership Foundation perspective, because we've had our board asking us exactly those questions. Why do you operate in the countries you do, and how are you thinking about it? So we've set up an international governance group with board members and external members. Thank you to Christine, who's on that board. And we are operating in Libya and in Iraq, and had inquiries from Afghanistan, for example. So though all of those issues, not just ethical issues, but also safety and security issues for staff, and indeed for those who come to run programs with us, are absolutely paramount. We've also gone into training for staff, again, to do with security issues as much as with ethical issues.
Okay. Anybody else like to deal with that, with the ethical issues? I mean, do you have a code of conduct, for example, at an individual university, or the British Council suggests anything like that, or HE Global got anything, any guidelines on that? So, Joe?
Certainly this is a sort of significant issue, particularly when you reflect back on what happened with various institutions who had links with Libya, and, some of the sort of very negative media coverage that arose last year. Certainly from within my own institution, I guess our view would be that individual institutions are autonomous, and yes, they should be looking at considering ethical risks in formulating any partnership, but certainly I don't think we'd necessarily support something that was prescriptive and one size fits all for the entire sector. But certainly it is a massive it is a massive issue, and it's one that institutions in setting up any partnership should be mindful of.
But in the end, it's for individual institutions, would be your view.
Yeah.
Kevin, was that view you take as well? Or?
Yes, I mean, it is. I think it's the British Council has the same position. I mean, we're a cultural relations organisation. We work in most of these countries. We even have people in North Korea. So I think our view is the cultural relations will continue, because in a sense, whatever happens in political relationships, cultural relations will always have a role. And education is core to cultural relations. So from a British Council perspective, we take that view, but it is up to the universities to make decisions.
I can see it'd be very difficult for British Council to make any sort of public pronouncement. But if an individual institution had some concerns about if they came for a quiet word with the British Council, or indeed HG Global, would you sort of give them a little bit of gentle warning?
British Council would, yes.
You would, yes. Okay. Yeah.
For a fee.
There we are. Vincenzo, any particular issues that have arisen for Nottingham in terms of ethical considerations?
I guess, like others in this room have experienced, it's very easy to be flattered on these overseas activities and to get into relationships, educational relationships that you wouldn't get into if you were at home. I think one of the ways we've tried to manage this at Nottingham is through the development of our TNE committee, which has a range of people representing different faculties and different professional services, that tries to manage these activities and approves conversations before they go too far. So, and I think, you know, there's a lot of experience now of institutions, including my own, that have been very happy to sign MOUs very, very quickly. And it's interesting looking at some parts of the world, Japan I'm thinking of, where there's a real courtship process before you get into signing these documents. And I think, you know, we really do need to think carefully before we, I don't want to keep going down this road, getting to bed with people that we might regret later.
Okay, question in the middle there, and then we'll try and get one on further on as well.
Good morning, Stuart Bannerman, University of Essex. Actually, it strikes me that universities were doing a very good job of T&E before this rather recent frenzy of activity from the agencies, which might be seen as possibly reactionary. But for those of us who were around at Going Global 2011 in Hong Kong, there was a major announcement there of a major infrastructural project that was really too big for individual institutions, and there was a kind of paralysis, if you like, around the major agencies, and that no one wished to take forward the initiative of being the agency around which to crystallise a possible joint British-UK venture. So given, you know, it's really a question for across the panel, how would the panel like to see major infrastructural initiatives taken forward to really see something happen, rather than providing what might be seen as window dressing around what is already a very effective sector?
Okay, well, before we come to Kevin and Joe, perhaps want to answer, but let's get sort of an independent view on it. Perhaps Robin, what would you see as a way towards that?
I think you raise a very important question. And I've often thought that in England we're surprisingly uncooperative across institutions. I say England very deliberately. And particularly when you compare how we operate as a country from, say, and I know these are small countries, but how Norway might operate, or the Dutch universities marketing together collectively into India, for example. So I think there is a lot of opportunity for much more joint working. I know institutions do work together jointly, but at agency level, I take your point, and I think there is. It's very difficult to see which single agency could do it, but together we certainly have the agency power in the UK to work collaboratively to help the sector.
Okay, Vincenzo?
Just to start off by disagreeing slightly with Robin in the sense that I think that UK universities and English universities have long experience of collaborating successfully in recruitment, There are good examples like the BritMEX consortium that ran for about 10 years very successfully in Mexico. So we can cooperate when we want to. Nottingham and Birmingham, as some of you may know, signed an agreement over a year ago now to work more closely together. We've developed a joint office. They've joined our office, which has now become a joint office in Brazil, for example. In terms of agency involvement and government involvement, if the activities that we're undertaking have a commercial lead, I don't want these government agencies involved. I think we need to do these things because we have a clear rationale for doing them, and that we'll achieve the objectives that we want. So the Hong Kong initiative or a Korea initiative that are probably going to be more around money, I think we need to leave them out and draw an activity that will pay for us in however you want to define pay. I think where we need the government agencies is in parts of the world where we wouldn't otherwise be able to be active without government involvement. So, for example, if we're wanting to develop some activity in parts of Africa, let's say, or you know, Libya was one of the examples where we're trying to develop a future market or support capacity development, then clearly we're stronger as a country and we need government support. And I do find it. Christine Enyu, the person who was meant to speak here, and I went to give some support to Cairo University on the development of their international branch, which is now stalled for obvious reasons. And we turned up there with our 2 or 3 days worth of free consultancy. There were colleagues there from USAID with shed loads of US dollars. And, you know, I think we were helpful and we did a good job, but it's very difficult for the UK when you're there with, you know, 2 people, 3 days, and USAID with shed loads of dollars. Very difficult to compete.
Okay, so, Joe, Kevin, should British Council, should HG Global be turning up with shed loads of pounds? Is there paralysis about major structural initiatives from quasi-governmental organisations? Joe first.
I mean, I don't think there's paralysis, certainly in terms of us actually establishing the HE Global Service. We've had good input from certainly from government departments and other agencies as well, in terms of their actual support for the initiative. I mean, I wouldn't say that it's been consistent across the board with all partners, and certainly we do need to perhaps develop relationships with certain partners that haven't been traditionally sort of used or marketed to the higher education sector to raise awareness about what they can offer. But I think on the theme of sector collaboration as well, I mean, clearly that there's a degree to which institutions might collaborate with each other, but given that there's also competition, that's sort of quite hard to do. But another element of what we're looking at is perhaps where we can foster collaboration within the sector and the sharing of good practice, we will try and do that. And certainly a key strand of the workshops that we had within HE Global recently was, well, what mechanisms can we utilise to allow for the sharing of experiences, whether good or bad? And clearly, particularly with the bad experiences, perhaps institutions aren't going to be too willing to shout about where they've attempted to do things and where they've gone wrong. But if there's some mechanism whereby they can do that anonymously, or they can do that in a sort of private forum, whether that's sort of via a login or a secure element of the website, or just at events where everything is you know, kind of Chatham House rules apply, then you know, perhaps there is scope to develop more activities that relate to sort of sector collaboration and the sharing of good practice. Because I think that there's an acknowledgement there that if, as was the example within Australia, if something is set up and it then goes wrong, it has implications not only for that institution but for the whole UK higher education brand. And therefore, I think there is a willingness to accept that and perhaps build on that.
Okay, and Kevin?
But the British Council provides on-the-ground support, and I think for TNE, which is what we're talking about today, we've done that probably for 75 years, to be honest, because we've always been on the ground when institutions have been delivering programs in country. As Vincenzo said, you know, TNE's been going on for a long time. I mean, we only significantly got involved about 10 years ago, but I think we provide that on-the-ground support, and we support the sector where we're needed. I think that's key for the British Council. So we're there in countries where the sector or institutions want to develop partnerships. But I think, more generally, the Education UK brand, the Prime Minister's Initiative, 1 and 2, which were funded by the previous government, both were, I think, initiatives which were global and which were looking at working with the sector and across government to develop strategies and to try and promote the UK. Both of those, well, the PMI has ended, Education UK brand is no longer funded by government. There isn't any more government support for these big initiatives. So we have to look at country by country basis. UKAIRI, the China and Brazil examples that Joe gave earlier, I think are good examples of the sector working together with government and the agencies. And that's the kind of thing I think we need to develop in the future.
OK, thanks.
Can I just come back to that? The difficulty the British Council now finds itself in is that it started life as this cultural organisation representing the UK and supporting us, and it's now trying to compete in the commercial arena by offering services to us at a fee. But your baseline is not a commercial baseline, and therefore you have an unfair advantage in the competitive environment. And I think, you know, we need to see far greater competition for the British Council now that it's entered this new arena. And I think, you know, wanting it will now cost me, if I go to Bangladesh tomorrow on your list of countries to look at, it will cost me £250 to have a conversation with somebody in Bangladesh about that. And I think we as in the sector are going to look to you, if we're paying those sums of money, for value for money and a return on that investment. And I don't think that your mentality as an organisation is there yet to support us in the way that we want support in a commercial environment.
Okay, you want to leave that?
Just very briefly, just to say, we have been charging for services since the 1980s, since the Education Counselling Service was set up. It's just we've changed the way we charge those services. And I think we are becoming, we do realise there's a competitive threat. There are other agencies who can offer the services, and we are going to improve our game.
Well, we've moved from a partnership, a two-way partnership, to a service.
It's becoming a very interesting subtopic, this one. We are almost out of time, but chap there did just catch my eye, so we'll take one very quick question. It'll be a quick one, I'm afraid.
Within the statistics for transnational education, as has been mentioned, one institution accounts for a fair bit. International branch campuses still account for very much a minority. There seems to be lots of information around the branch campuses, case studies and all that. I've come across a lot less around all the other parts of transnational education, distance learning, collaborative provision, all that. Is the panel able to point to any good sources of information about what institutions are doing in those other areas of TNE? What's growing, what's working, what isn't working?
Okay, so a good source of that statistical information. Can anybody suggest anything?
Just a comment on the data, of course. It's, as I think Kevin said, it's incredibly misleading because the HESA data counts bodies overseas, whereas in the UK it counts FTE. So although I said that there are more people studying overseas than in the UK, not necessarily in FTE terms. There's a lot of information on different university websites, and we're going to hear later on from Tim Gore, but a good place to start is actually the London External website. And just looking at the list of institutions that they work with, the whole range of partners that they've worked with over many, many years delivering their programmes is a good source of advice.
Okay, and Robin, quickly.
Well, I'd also mention the Nottingham Partnership Forum, which is a forum where colleagues from the sector get together, you know, once a year. There's no charge, and it really is Chatham House rules, because it's colleagues talking together about these kinds of things.
And Robin, do you have a suggestion for statistical source?
Several. If you look at the American website, the International Education Exchange, whatever it is, there's quite a lot of data there. And UNESCO, obviously, and OECD, if you want statistics. If you want case studies and stories of what works and so on, there are a number of TNE publications coming out. one just recently, actually, from IEE, which is a series of examples of different kinds of collaborations from different countries. There's quite a heavy US bias, but there are UK examples in there as well. And then on networks, the International Unit and the Leadership Foundation have set up a network for exchanges of experience on TNE. And the Leadership Foundation and the International Unit as well have published a series of research reports. The author of several of those, John Fielden, is in the audience and will speak later. But those have got quite a lot of case examples. We were particularly keen on one of them to look at partnerships between Australia and the UK and to look at both sides of the partnerships. So there are quite a bit out there.
Lovely. Thank you very much for writing. Having had wonderful discipline on timing during the speakers, I managed to let it run over a little bit during the Q&A, but thank you for all your questions and for the answers. And we move now to a refreshment break. Refreshments are back in room 715, 716, which is where you first came in. Unless you're watching on the web, and I guess you're going to have to sort out your own refreshments. And then we're back in here at 12, maybe just a few minutes after 12 to make up for that time, just to briefly remind you about the evaluation forms. And can we thank our panel speakers for this morning's session. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from PolicyReview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.